Perhaps you know someone whose life experience has undergone multiple setbacks. You know someone like that? The death of a parent at a young age, then the sickness of the living parent, and perhaps then having to take the children and either put them with a relative, a grandparent, or maybe even foster care because the living parent is so ill, he or she cannot take care of his or her own children. And then high school graduation, but then no money for college. And then another family economic reversal. And then early marriage and a first child and then a divorce. And then more economic challenges that come with that. And then remarriage and then a sick child of the second marriage. And then after that, the death of the new spouse. Multiple setbacks. This series of hardships I just mentioned, I have no one in mind in particular. But perhaps you know someone in your own experience who has experienced multiple setbacks. Where a person, maybe even yourself, where you are disadvantaged in some way and you're beginning to pull out of it, and then a new hardship comes and eradicates momentum or resources or opportunity, and you're back to the proverbial square one. You don't want someone like that? Have you experienced something like that yourself? For Abraham, what we're going to consider today in Genesis 22, up until now, every trouble seems to have been resolved at this point of the game. Right now, he's pretty close to 99. He has most of his life now in a status of peace. And up until this chapter 22, many of the obstacles that he has had to face have all been circumstantial. Childlessness, circumstantial. Famine, circumstantial. Human strife, circumstantial, and so forth. We come now to Genesis 22, and it's no longer a circumstantial obstacle. The obstacle that Abraham is going to face in this passage is God himself. God himself is going to face off with Abraham. So today we're going to look at this most famous passage. I'm calling it the father's testing of a beloved son. Let me read to you our text today from Genesis 22, beginning in verse 1. After these things, God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham. And he said, Here I am. He said, Take your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. So Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, took two of his young men with him and his son Isaac. He cut the wood for the burnt offering and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. On the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place from afar. Then Abraham said to his young men, Stay here with the donkey, and I and the boy will go over there and worship, and will come again to you. And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac his son. And he took in his hand the fire and the knife, so that they both went together. And Isaac said to his father, Abraham, My father? He said, Here I am, my son. He said, Behold, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering? Abraham said, God will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. And they both of them went together. When they came to that place of which God had told him, Abraham built an altar there and laid the wood in order and bound Isaac his son and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then Abraham reached out his hand and took the knife to slaughter his son. And the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. He said, Here I am. He said, Do not lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, seeing that you have not withheld your son, your only son from me. And Abraham lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him was a ram caught in the thicket by his horns. The Lord and Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up as a burnt offering instead of his son. So Abraham called the place, the name of that place, the Lord will provide. As it is said to this day, on the mount of the Lord it shall be provided. The angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven. He said, by myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you. I will surely multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven and as the sand that is on the seashore. And your offspring shall possess the gates of his enemies. And in your offspring shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice. So Abraham returned to his young men, and they arose and went together to Beersheba. And Abraham lived in Beersheba. Well, the passage is about testing, and we're not going to be able to cover everything perhaps this passage has raised up in your own hearts and minds. We'll try and touch on some of it as it relates to this idea of testing that God has given to him and the testing that God gives to us, which is really what I want to stress this morning after we look at just this idea of testing in general. So follow along with me idea by idea. If you're taking notes, let me tell you what to write down on point one. You don't have to, but if you like to take notes, let me ask you to write down this: the Father's testing as a general experience. Because there is a sense in which the concept of God testing his people is a very common practice by God. It's a common experience that God's people experience. And maybe even just saying that is helpful to you. If you're experiencing a test or a hardship or an adversity, it's sometimes hard to put a proper label on it. And so what I'm trying to do is give you a label. You need to put, among other things, this label: God is testing me. That's what he's doing. And God has done this throughout the history of his people, and he's continuing to do it now. There is a general sense in which God does this. He tests his people, and whatever adversity you might be experiencing now or have experienced in the past or shall experience, because it is inevitable that you will, that you need to know what is happening to you. You need to know that, among other things, God is testing you. And it's a general thing. Let me just give you a couple of examples, an Old Testament example, a New Testament example, and we'll talk about a historical example and what God is after, just under this point one, the general testing experience by God. First, an Old Testament example. In one of my favorite Old Testament sections in the book of Deuteronomy is Deuteronomy chapter 8. Deuteronomy itself is a series of sermons that Moses gives to the people of God before they enter the land. As you might remember, Moses is going to be kept from entering the land. And so these five sermons or so are designed to prepare them for what they're going to experience, to instruct them according to what the things that God is going to want them to observe while they're in the land. And Moses says in this section, as he reflects back on the last 40 years, Deuteronomy 8, verse 2, and you shall remember the whole way the Lord your God has led you these 40 years. 40 years is a long time to be tested, isn't it? 40 years, and many of you in this room are not even 40 years old. A 40-year-long test is a long time. In the wilderness. So not only was there a test given for 40 years, but it was in a setting that was known really for deprivation. Not having stuff. Not having water. Not having, you know, savory food. That he might humble you. Testing you to know what was in your heart. And there's the why of the test. God, why does God test? At least why did God test the people of God in the wilderness? He says so, that he might humble you, to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. He humbled you and let you hunger and fed you with manna. The provision itself was a test. Sometimes people in their youth, in their teen years, early 20s, they desperately pray to be married. And God is pleased to bring them a spouse. Unknown to them, marriage itself is a test. Marriage is a journey. Marriage often is adversity. Not always. But it's designed on purpose to be that way. Sometimes when you are prospering and God gives you wealth, that is a significant test. When God deprives you, that's a test. There's a whole, God is all about this. A New Testament example is James chapter 1, a very classic passage on testing. James chapter 1, verse 2. Consider it pure joy, my brothers, when you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith develops perseverance, develops endurance. There is a rationale for God's testing of you. God is seeking to grow you. He is seeking to mature you. He is seeking to build into you something you do not now have. And let me just say that whatever God decides to use isn't itself a guarantee that you are going to mature. Sometimes adversity can make you bitter. Sometimes wealth can make you extremely proud and self-centered and self-sufficient and cause you to leave the faith. No, that's not what those are designed to accomplish at all. It's how we respond to these trials that work this thing that James says is to be achieved, perseverance, endurance. And we must not also forget the testing of Jesus himself. Jesus himself was tested. After he was baptized by the baptizer, the Spirit of God came upon him. And then shortly afterwards, after that affirmation from his Father, he was thrust out into the wilderness to be tempted 40 days and 40 nights with hunger and deprivation. And then it says, I think one of the texts, I think it's Matthew or Luke's gospel, it says, and then he became hungry. And then the devil brought his own tests. By God's permission, to be sure. But he assaulted him. Testing is a very common thing. Testing is going to be a common thing for you if it is not already going on. See, what is God after when he tests us? What is he seeking to achieve? In Hebrews chapter 8, this is a commentary on the passage that we're going to consider this morning from Genesis. Hebrews chapter 8, 11 verse 8 says, by faith Abraham, when called to go, obeyed and went, for he was looking forward to the city, here it is, with foundations, whose architect and builder is God. What is God after when he tests us? He's after this. What are your foundations? That's what he's after. Do you know what they are? God's testing is seeking to unearth for our own sakes. What are we resting on? What are we trusting in? Ian Murray wrote a two-volume biography on Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones, and I heard a sermon recently on this, and he makes reference, this preacher makes reference to this particular time from this biography, and I had that biography, I read it. I went back to try and find exactly where this story is from, and I couldn't exactly find it, so I'm not saying this guy was misrepresenting. I just said I couldn't find it, but here's a story. You might know Martin Lloyd-Jones, a very famous, he is a preacher. He's famous to me, at least. Hopefully he's famous to you. But he was a British preacher in England, at Westminster Chapel. He was preaching during the World War II in England. Very well known, a whole series of commentaries formulated out of his sermons and the like. But before Martin Lloyd-Jones was a pastor, he was a physician. He was a doctor. A very well-trained doctor. He was being trained by one of the chief physicians at St. Bartholomew's Hospital, the hospital that takes care of royalty. The kings of England were cared for by the doctors at St. Bartholomew's Hospital. The members of parliament were as well. Lloyd-Jones was a very brilliant, aspiring medical diagnostician. He could analyze very accurately, very well. He was on the road to a great wealth and success in the medical field. And on one particular day, he was practicing. He was a doctor there in St. Bart's, and he a knock came to his door. And it was one of the chiefs of staff, one of the chief medical doctors at St. Bart's, who asked if he could come into his room and sit by his fire. And so in his office, he had a fire there. And sure, by all means, please sit. And so this MD came and sat in Lloyd Jones's room there in what he perceived as a dazed look on his face, sat down next to the fire and didn't say a word for 2 hours. And Lloyd Jones had discovered that this physician had lost his fiancée. She died suddenly. He looked at this man who, in one sense, had everything in the world that the world could offer. Had it economically, socially, professionally, personally. And when he saw this man, I mean, in grief. Now, nothing wrong with grieving. And when you lose somebody suddenly, it is shocking. And takes quite a long time to recover. And so it wasn't so much this guy didn't do anything out of the ordinary, except how it influenced Lloyd-Jones. It moved him. It unsettled him. It unnerved him. Lloyd-Jones looked at a man who, in a certain sense, had everything the world had to offer, and suddenly he realized that even the most powerful, even the most prosperous, no matter who you are, the foundations of one's security is always vulnerable. Always. He said he was staring at a man who had everything going for him, and suddenly he realized the vanity of all human greatness. See, what's he talking about? He's talking about foundations. This man had a foundation, and it was blown out of the water. And this man was beside himself. You see, that Deuteronomy passage that I mentioned, I didn't read the rest of that section. Moses says, "And he humbled you, let you hunger, fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you know that man does not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord." See, what are your foundations? What are your foundations? When God brings a test to you, that's what he's wanting to bring to your attention. He's wanting you to know that. He's wanting you to know that even though, as Christians, we claim to trust God, and as Christians, we claim to make God our trust, but to claim that when your life is going very, very well is one thing. But to claim that when your life, under God's oversight, is going very, very poorly is quite another. And often we don't even know what ultimately we're trusting in until it's tested. Perhaps the most vivid example of this is the testing of Job. When early in the Job story, as you recall, Job, the wealthiest, the most prosperous, the most devout man on the face of the earth, all is going well for Job. Job is blessed beyond human measure. And then Satan says to God, "Of course Job serves you. Of course he follows you. Of course he worships you. Who wouldn't? Look at all the stuff you give to him. Who wouldn't worship you when you give him protection, you give him wealth, you give him prosperity, you give him status, you give him everything he possibly could ever want. Who wouldn't? But if you touch it, he'll curse you to your face." And God said, "Okay, but spare his life." And the first round, of course, he loses everything, all of his wealth. He loses his children. In the second round, he loses his health. And Job is spiraling downward, trying to make sense out of it. See, what is that about? It's about your foundations. It's about Job's foundations. It's about the foundations of Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones. It's about yours and mine. See, when God tests you, he is after something. He's after something that you are unaware of at this stage of the game, and he wants to elevate your consciousness about what is deep down in your soul. So that's the first point, dealing with just the general practice of God's testing of the people of God. Let me observe a second point. I'm calling this the Father's unique test. So the first part is Father's testing as a general experience for Christians, and now the Father's unique test, his unique test of Abraham. And notice Genesis chapter 22, verse 1. After these things, God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham, and Abraham said, here I am. He said, take your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land that of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. Now, if you happen to be reading your Bible, have your Bible open, and not looking at the text that's in your bulletin, I took the liberty of rearranging some of the terminology in this text in your bulletin. Because almost without exception, the New American Standard does this, the NIV does this, the ESV does this, rearranges the terminology to reflect, I think, a more customary English way of rendering, but not the Hebrew. And that is to put Isaac at the end. Take your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac. But most of your versions will say, take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love. I want to just make an observation about that. And I think there's a reason why the Hebrew text leaves it that way. And as I've meditated on it, I have to wonder if maybe there is a sense in which there is a tacit inclination for us to look for every possible way to avoid what God is commanding us to do, using God's own terminology. So if Abraham had heard, take your son and offer him, Isaac would say, well, I have at least two. I can offer the one I don't want to. Hell, I can offer Ishmael. Take your son, your only son. Well, he is the only son of his mother. I'll still take Ishmael. Take the son whom you love. Well, I love my sons both the same way. Isaac. There is a sense in which the Hebrew Bible depicts, I think, some of the building anticipation of the horror of this commandment. Abraham knows what this means. He knows that this is God's voice. He's heard God's voice before. He has cherished God's voice for 25 years. God's voice has comforted him for 25 years. The memory of God's voice has directed him for 25 years. He heard God's voice back in Genesis chapter 12, and it's guided him. God hasn't spoken to him that very much. If the Genesis record is a record of all the times God has spoken to him in 25 years, he hasn't spoken to him very much. And therefore, I think Abraham does recognize the voice of God when he hears it. He knows this to be the voice of God. And whereas before it comforted him, whereas before it excited him, whereas before it seemed to be something that he willingly embraced and followed, here I think I'd be hard pressed to believe that he enjoyed hearing it today. It gave him dread as he contemplated what God himself was commanding him to do. Notice the immediate response, verse 3. So Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, took two of his young men with him, his servants, and his son Isaac. He cut the wood for the burnt offering and rose and went to the place of which God has told him. Very matter of fact, no conversation, no dialogue, no comment, no debate, no negotiation. Unlike what we noticed the last time we saw Abraham engaging God, where he was appealing to God for Sodom, where he was negotiating what seemed to be based on God's principle of justice, how God's justice wouldn't prevail and destroy Sodom. And he was humbly asking God to consider, and God considered and went from 50 to 45 to 40 to 30 to 20 to 10. And he was satisfied. Nothing. There's only simple obedience. Then it seems to be Abraham is withdrawn into himself as he walks with these three others, two servants and his beloved son. The next verse, verse 4, says they walked for 3 days. Nothing is mentioned about what they were saying, if anything. I have to imagine. I think as I've meditated on the age of Isaac at this time, I would put him, you know, somewhere around 10 to maybe 15 years old. Depending on the kind of son you have, you might have a son that is a talker. Maybe you have a son who's not a talker. I think when boys are around friends, they talk a lot. I'm going to assume that Abraham was overhearing much of the conversation between Isaac and these two servants, whom he certainly knew. Abraham seems to be, he's silent for the entire time that he's there. And then, verse 4, on the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place from afar. 3 days of very little conversation, if any. 3 days meditating on the command. 3 days of silence, mulling it over what he is planning to do to his hopes and his son. And then it says he excuses himself, verse 5, so that the two of them may traverse the last leg of this journey by themselves. And Isaac by now is, I think, able to discern something isn't quite right. He certainly has been a part of sacrifices before. He knows sacrifices involve a number of things. An altar made of whatever you can find, okay, that's not a problem. He knows sacrifices are made up of wood. Sacrifices are made up of the killing of an animal and then the burning of that animal's body. And so he says in this next verse, Isaac said to his father, "My father," he said, "here I am, my son. Behold, the fire and the wood. But where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" What a question. Abraham said, "God will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering, my son." You know, verses 1 through 8 of this passage summarizes the events of 3 days. So it's extremely compressed. And then these next two verses is as if it were in very, very, very slow motion. They came to the place of which God had told them. Abraham built an altar there and laid the wood in order. Now, what's going on here? He's preparing for a sacrifice, and Isaac is watching. Abraham bound Isaac, his son, and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. And Abraham reached out his hand and took the knife. And let me just observe here, this word for knife is not like a dagger. It really is a cleaver. This is going to be a bloody affair. And the next language in the ESV says to slaughter his son. Now, this is abhorrent to us. What's happening here? What is this all about here? Well, it does seem to be immoral and wrong to us, but there is a principle that we need to know about that's operating here in the life of Abraham, in the life of Isaac, and among these peoples of the ancient Near East. It is called the principle or law of the firstborn. The law of the firstborn. Now, we know how the firstborn generally operates. The firstborn son is the one who receives all the inheritance, the wealth from the father. Now, when you think about it, today, when we have inheritances, typically we will, when it comes down to the last living relative, and he has or she has the wealth, the wealth is then distributed equally among the living children. That's generally how we would expect it to go. That isn't how it happened there. It happened very differently, that the inheritance was to be deposited into the hand of the firstborn. All of it. All of it was to be deposited under his care. And the rest of the children then were to be recipients of the benefits of that firstborn's management of that wealth. And there's a reason for that. The reason is this. It's kind of like the principle of divide and conquer. In order for the man who has accumulated all of his wealth, which means wealth, status, power, and influence, to maintain that status, power, and influence, the wealth has to stay in the possession of one person. If it is divided amongst the children, divide and conquer, the wealth and status and influence also is divided. And so to maintain what has been accumulated through the accumulation of the wealth and the status of that parent, it must be maintained by all that resting in the hands and possession of that one firstborn. And so there's a sense in which we know that to be the case, but there's something more here. There's something more. John Levinson, who wrote a book, The Death and Resurrection of Beloved Son, he's a Jewish scholar. I don't think he's a Christian, although he interacted with the New Testament text on this subject, made the observation that there's a principle operating, and we remember hearing it as we read through Leviticus and Numbers. Probably haven't read Leviticus and Numbers for quite some time, but you remember it, and I'm going to say it, this verse that says, the life of the firstborn is mine. Remember that? The life of the firstborn is mine. And that's why the firstborn cattle is then sacrificed. The firstborn of the grain harvested is sacrificed. And even more amazingly, the firstborn is forfeit to God. For example, think of the Passover. When God brings judgment on the Egyptians, the Egyptians as a nation are not affected, but the firstborn of the family is. And even in Jewish households, the firstborn will be taken unless blood has been shed and a cover is made over the door mantle. The only way the firstborn, even of an Israelite family, is to be preserved is if it is redeemed by blood. Over and over again, the life of the firstborn belongs to God. Over and over again, the life of the firstborn is forfeit unless it is redeemed, unless a sacrifice is made, unless payment is made. And the ancients of this world would know that. Abraham would know that. Everyone understood that. And what that really means is this, that there's a debt of sin every family owes. And the firstborn is payment. And the only way that the firstborn can be spared is if there is a substitute for that firstborn. Now listen, if Abraham had heard the voice of God to say something like, Abraham, and go and offer Sarah, then I'll know. No, Abraham said, no, that's ridiculous. That's irrational. He would have known that is not the voice of God. But when he said, go and offer your firstborn, he understood it. When God says, offer your firstborn, he is saying that God is a God of justice, and God's justice must be paid. As we all know, it needs to be paid. But here's somewhat of the quandary, because the God of justice is at odds with the God of promise. Because it is in this firstborn that is being commanded to be offered that all the hopes, not only for Abraham, but for the world, now it is hanging. Make another observation here before we move on to the third point here. And it gets back to foundations. Abraham is being commanded here to do something that he has never been commanded to do before. He's been called in Genesis 12, as you recall, it was a very big step to leave everything behind, to leave his family, to leave his kindred, to leave everything, and to go to a land, he says, where I will show you. But there is a sense in which all the previous calls upon the life of Abraham had with it some incentive. Leave your family because I'm going to give you a new family. Leave your land because I'm going to give you a new land. Until now. Until now. There's nothing to gain here. There is no explicit promise to balance the loss here. There's no covenant to offer motivation for his obedience. In fact, it is not only his son that he's putting on the sacrificial altar as a payment for justice. It appears to be the covenant and the promise and the future for the world as well. You know, so, you know, has Abraham's faith been motivated by personal gain? Or simply by his love for God? Up until now, we don't really know. And let me just now just to step back a little bit before I go into the third point here. I think that's also the case with us. You know, our God testing of us, God impressing whatever challenge upon us, you know, are we going to follow the Lord? Be strictly because of love for him. That's always going to be the issue. You know, there's always the temptation to think, well, I serve the Lord, I did this, and I gave this, and I, you know, sacrificially, all these things, and this is what I get in return? Forget it. That's often. I have felt that in the past. What is our motive for following the Lord? A test often brings it to the surface. I think it's fair to say that God already knew, even though it says, now I know. I find that to be very perplexing. Now I know. And maybe what he's doing is he's saying that as a way for us, for Abraham to say, now I know I fear God because I was willing. I don't know. But I think there is a sense in which we often do not know. Just how far am I willing to follow the Lord? Just under what circumstances would I say enough's enough? I think there's always going to be a sense in which God is going to bring you to that point. And maybe some of you are there now. Enough's enough. I'm on the brink. I'm at the end. Well, one more point. Hopefully this will encourage you. So there's the Father's testing as a general experience. There's the Father's unique test upon Abraham. And now let me observe this lastly, the Father's ultimate gift. Of course, verse 11 says, the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham, stop, don't do that. And then Abraham, verse 13, lift up his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him was a ram caught in the thicket by his horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up as a burnt offering instead of his son. Now, it's interesting to think about all the historic firstborns. Many of the historic firstborns were demoted. You know, Cain was the firstborn. He was demoted for Abel. Esau was the firstborn. He was demoted for Jacob. Reuben was the firstborn. He was demoted for Judah. Joseph's son Manasseh was the firstborn. He was demoted for Ephraim. Each of these demoted firstborns received grace. Cain received grace after his murder. Esau received grace after he threatened to murder. Isaac was spared when God provides a substitute for him. You know, when Jesus was the firstborn, he was the firstborn both by right and by love. On his baptism, God said to him, behold, my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. The Father was infinitely pleased with his Son. He was the firstborn by right and the firstborn by love. And on the cross, Jesus received the ultimate demotion as the Lamb of Slaughter. It's quite stunning, the imagery in Genesis 22. Isaac, the sacrificial son, walking the rest of the way to his own Calvary with wood strapped to his back. That kind of sounds familiar, doesn't it? Isaac was bound like a lamb is upon the altar. Jesus was bound, of course, on the cross. The mountain itself in the land of Moriah, in 2 Chronicles, the land of Moriah, the mountain by the same name is the place ultimately where Jerusalem was built. And so it's believed that this place where Isaac was offered was the place where Jesus also died. On the cross, the justice of God and the promise, the God of justice and the God of promise are reconciled. The God of justice demanding the firstborn, and the God of promise sparing that firstborn so that the later son of Isaac would not be spared. Now, the language of sparing is picked up again in Romans chapter 8, where the apostle says, he who spared not his own son. See, why does God seem to pile it on the lives of some Christians? You know, we had a church member, no longer worships with us, and I'm not going to use the name of this church member. You might know who she is. She came out here from the East Coast, married. She was previously married and went through a very terrible divorce. Married somebody out here, and they started coming to our church. And their very first born child was severely autistic. Their second born child was emotionally distressed. And a third born child, in many ways, just very ordinary. Then there was a very sudden death of her second husband. And it seemed to me, from my vantage point, a pile on. Now, In fairness, her situation wasn't the worst Christians have had to suffer. She didn't have her body torn limb from limb for professing Christ. She didn't have she wasn't executed for believing in Christ, and her children sold off into slavery. And some Christians have had to go through that as they have made professions for Christ's sake. But her suffering would seem to me, in my personal opinion, excessive. Why? I don't know. Why is God pile it on you? I don't know. But let me just give you a couple of encouragements. The book of Hebrews says in chapter 11, verse 19, you can write down the verse and go back to it on your own. It says, Abraham considered that God was able even to raise him from the dead. As you recall, in Genesis chapter 22, verse 6, he says to the young men, we will go and worship, and he says, we will come back. Now, it doesn't make this Hebrews verse explicit, but the Hebrews author draws, I think, out of that, realizing when he said, we will return, that Abraham believed that he was, in fact, going to go through with it, but God would raise him up. And my encouragement to you is simply to observe the verse, the part of the verse that says, Abraham considered that God was able. You need to cling on to that. I don't have the authority to say, in your trial, like Abraham's trial and like Job's trial, there's going to be a glorious ending. I don't have the authority to say that to you. It might very well be that you'll go to the grave in suffering. But let me just say that God is able. God is able. God is able to turn it around. God is able to intervene. God is able to give you the strength you need. God is able to give you joy because he spared not his own son for you. You've got to realize that. He spared not his own son for you. So that when you're having to give up for him, that he hasn't forgotten you. Let me say one more thing as well. You know, we just celebrated the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation, and one of the great insights of Martin Luther is this, something he called the theology of the cross. The theology of the cross compared to the theology of glory. Theology of glory says this. Theology of glory says that the Christian life is to be one of total and continual triumph, victory, success, wealth, and ease, without hardship, without suffering, without adversity. It uses verses like this. I came that you might have life and might have it abundantly. Well, what does that really mean to you? We think about, wow, abundance. I want abundance, don't you? I want to have life, don't you? Of course, I do, don't you? But we often read into it wrongly. Luther said there is a theology of glory, but that's future. We're called to live out what he calls the theology of the cross. Theology of the cross is this, a theology that resembles the earthly life of Jesus. Jesus said himself, the fox have holes, the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. Jesus lived a life, humanly speaking, of abject poverty. When he invites you, when he calls you to himself, when he brings you into saving relationship with him, all bets are off. You follow him, the Lamb, wherever he leads you. He had a physical life of poverty. He had no home to call his own. He had no money. He was depending on the gifts of others to continue his ministry. When he died, all he had in his possession was the cloak that they eventually stripped off and divided amongst themselves. He had nothing. When the theology of the cross is that we are called to resemble the earthly life of Jesus, the theology of the cross is a call to resemble the words of Jesus. He said, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. Jesus didn't carry the cross just the last 12 hours of his life. He carried a cross for 33 years. And he calls you to the same. He calls you by grace. He saves you by free grace. But in saving you, he says, follow me. And when you follow him, you follow by carrying your cross daily. You pick it up when you wake up in the morning. You might be able to lay it down when you sleep, if you get sleep. But you walk with him, you follow the Lamb wherever he goes, and you live a life that he lived. Luther taught theology of the cross. The weapons of our warfare are not of this world. The theology of the cross says, the first shall be last. Do you want to be great in God's kingdom? Be the servant of all, Jesus says. That's the theology of the cross. We are called more to die for our enemies than to kill them, to give than to freely take from them, to turn the other cheek. That's the theology of the cross. Theology of the cross is to live a life of sacrifice, to live a life in which we give up. And that's what this test is about. What are we clinging to? What are we clinging? What are the things in your life that you think, if I don't have this, I'll absolutely fall to pieces? My advice to you as a pastor is to give them away to him. My advice to you as a pastor is to say, you know, I think, you know, I whatever it is, it could be your children, your spouse, your dreams, your hopes. Do they hold you captive? Theology of the cross is what this is about. You know, I want to encourage you. We're going to have a study of this in our life group if you would like to continue this discussion this Tuesday. It's a very, very vital part that we know how to take the test. If not the one we have taken, but the one that we are sure to have to take. To know where the resources are for taking it and succeeding. Are you in a test right now? Are you experiencing an overwhelming sense that I have no idea what I'm going to do next? I'd like to talk to you afterwards and pray with you. It'd be my hope to help you to realize that God is in control of your test. God is in control of your life. God is in control of the timing, the location of everything having to do with this test. Don't give up. Seek the help that God has given to you in the people of God, in his word, in his promises. He wants you to succeed. He wants you to persevere in faith in the same way Jesus has enabled you by his suffering and death. Let's pray. Dear Jesus, thank you for your willingness to go to the cross, to be the one about whom this verse in Romans 8:32, he who spared not his own son. I can't imagine the grievous, torturous feeling that the Father and the Son had as the decision now came to this point in history where the wrath of God, the sins of all of his people, past, present, and future, would be laid upon him, and he would be suffering under the wrath of God on the cross. He did it because he loved us all. And I pray, our Father, that we would come to grips with whatever test that you are giving to us or have given to us. Lord, it's easy for us to be bitter. It's easy for us to disbelieve that God really loves us and wants our very best in everything. It's easy for us to conclude wrongly, to interpret your providences wrongly. Would you help us to interpret them in the light of the cross? That on Jesus, you have laid our sin burden and, in effect, destroyed him. And now when you call us to persevere in joy and in trust with the knowledge that the theology of glory really is ours. The theology of glory will make this present suffering pale into insignificant by comparison. But we're destined for a future theology of glory, not a present one. Would you help us to make that a part of our interpretive grid for our experience, and the one that we share with others as we have occasion to encourage people who are suffering with a severe test. I thank you for the people of God here. And would you help us to journey in trusting you? Journey whatever it might require of us to not give up, not to throw in the towel, but to continue to trust, to seek the help that we need from others who can bring the living word to our consciousness so that we can have hope in our trial. And we'll continue to persevere together as a body for Jesus' sake. Amen. I'll have the ushers come forward now to receive this morning's tithes and offerings.